KNOM Profiles.
Yesterday, former North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta gave one of the closing speeches at the final day of the Arctic Imperative Summit, the gathering of government and industry leaders looking at development and opportunities in the Arctic. Itta gave the closing remarks last year and said then he spoke in the capacity of the borough mayor.
Since then, term limits have given me the opportunity to hand the torch over to my friend, Mayor Charlotte Brower, whom I wish the very best.
Itta said his term ended in November.
So I have had time to reflect on the future of the Arctic, and I no longer have to evaluate these events and issues strictly through the lens of a municipal government. Without that constraint, I tend to consider things from the perspective of who I am. A whaler and a hunter, in short, the perspective of an Inupiaq Eskimo. Last year, I talked about the historical relationships between the Inupiaq and the state of Alaska. My friend Mead here.
And he's speaking of Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell.
If you are not to worry, I'm not going to pick on the state this year. This year, I'd like to shift my focus on the relationship between the indigenous people of Alaska's far north and the U.S. federal government. I do so because what drives this discussion of an Arctic imperative is the likelihood of very large gas and oil discoveries in the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea. And as you all know or may not know, virtually all of that offshore territory is the exclusive province of our federal government. This single difference, the federal government, instead of the state as the landlord over development, changes the conversation significantly for my people, my fellow Inupiaq. We have a very different relationship to the federal government than we do to the state government. I am a resident of the state of Alaska in the eyes of the state, just like anyone else. But in my relationship with the federal government, I am also a member of a tribe. This is a very different relationship, and there's a good reason for the difference. The trust relationship. The Arctic Imperative is fascinating, second year. The opportunity to listen to great speakers, terrific speakers, knowledgeable people about aviation, fisheries, presidential elections, national security, oil and gas, they all intrigue me. So to build on that body of information, I'd like to talk with you just very briefly about Sitting Bull. Say what? Yes, I said Sitting Bull. The great chief of the Lakotas. As you know, the pioneer settlers moving into the Great Plains ran into a major obstacle. Namely, the people who already live in the land. The government's handling of this conflict has been generally considered one of the most shameful episodes in American history. And over the years, our great nation has tried to undo the mistakes in this regard. The settlement of the West was a land rush and a quest for the rich resources of the West. Similarities are there. Included in this land rush was the quest for not only gold, but also farmland, timber, fur, grazing, land, railroad, right-of-ways, mining. And in the midst of this chaos, the Indian tribes had to devise their own foreign policy for dealing with this endless procession of pioneers. Sitting Bull, as I said, was a great Lakota leader. He was a medicine man and a warrior. Sitting Bull's tribe was nomadic, as mine was just a generation and a half ago. Traveling the Great Plains in search of buffalo during the warm parts of the year and settling down near fresh water sources to wait out the cold months of winter. On several occasions in the 1860s and 1870s, the government negotiated treaties with various tribes in the region. What is interesting about Sitting Bull is that he would never sign a treaty. He understood what the railroads, the forts, the farms really meant. It meant that his ability to lead his tribe across the Great Plains to follow the sustenance the buffalo gave them would become severely limited. It's no secret that it didn't turn out well, so well for Sitting Bull and the Indians of the Great Plains, but that diplomatic failure motivated the creation of what I just mentioned a while ago, the trust relationship between the federal government and the native tribes that survived.
Itta said he believes the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, motivated by the Prudhoe Bay oil discovery and the construction of the oil pipeline, largely succeeded in giving Alaska Natives a fair trade.
First of all, the settlement recognized the importance of a land base that was essential to the continuation of the Native culture, the land. Second, it created the potential through that for the Native people to have a potential ownership stake in this development.
He said those two principles also need to be included in the next great wave of oil development.
So I'm saying I don't believe that the land claims extinguished Aboriginal claim to the ocean. And I know that's an uncomfortable notion for a lot of my industry friends and industry-related friends. And that's understandable. I don't expect industry to take a kindly to an assertion like this that I've just made. After all, they didn't take kindly to the push for native land claims either, just a few short years ago. If it's any consolation, I'm not suggesting we go file a lawsuit and lawyer up. I'm not saying that at all. Rather, my comment is based on America's historic vow not to repeat the mistakes of its early history, and therefore to do everything we can, given this opportunity, to do it right.
Itta asked how the federal government can develop oil and gas while honoring Native cultural values. He said it must be understood that there are two types of currency. One is cash, and one is the subsistence way of life.
Assuming that we can agree that subsistence is not just a buzzword and has actual value, which it does to us, it has actual value, then we can start to talk seriously. If the notion that subsistence has real value, we need to acknowledge that some of the areas of the ocean that we are talking with, particular to my region, are so important to Native cultural practices and our way of life that they should be protected from all development.
Itta said policy, procedures, and regulations for development need to be Arctic-specific, not taken from any other part of the world and simply adapted. Itta said that when he thinks about crossing the ocean to go hunting and whaling, his mind wanders to Sitting Bull. He said Sitting Bull never signed a treaty.
To do so would put an end to his tribe chasing buffalo across the open plain. He knew that. and he would never sign a treaty. In a lot of ways, it was parallel to what sometimes that I felt in my term as mayor the last 6 years, 5 years. In other words, to be confined to a reservation, he knew it would place his tribe into cultural bankruptcy. So his decision was clear. He was a Lakota Indian. He was meant to hunt buffalo. And when told to report to the reservation, he refused. I am no longer mayor. I am Edward Sakan Ita, an Inupiaq Eskimo, a hunter, and a whaler, and like Sitting Bull, I'm not going to go to that reservation. Thank you very much.
Attendees of the 2012 Arctic Imperative Summit again gave Edward Ita standing applause after his closing remarks. For KNOM Profiles, reporting in Girdwood, I'm Lorelei Kinneen.
Profiles is a production of KNOM News and Public Affairs.